We can improve the ability of being fast. Does our body have the capacity for fast outputs? But the skill of being fast is doing that very well, basically whenever and wherever. If you want to get faster, here's 5 speed training foundations for every coach and athlete. Enough waiting, let's get into it. So here are the 5 things. Technique / mechanics matter, 95% or better of your best, time your sprints, bridge the gap, and then I'll give you some actual concrete stuff that you can start doing tomorrow to start becoming faster. And of course, I have to include what didn't make the cut, because how can I boil down such a complex topic into just 5 things? But I did just for you. So it's very important to have an operational definition and some context for what I mean when I say speed training, because that's going to be the foundation of a lot of the things that I say of my 5 points, is coming back to this definition and how are we checking off 1, 2, or many of these components of this definition. So the definition of speed training is as such, defined by my colleagues and I. The training of sprint mechanics, shapes, patterns, rhythms, and maximizing force vectors across starting positions, acceleration, and transitioning to max velocity sprinting that leads to significant and measurable improvements in speed. So our technique and our mechanics for maximizing force vectors. So a vector has a magnitude and a direction. So we hit the ground hits us back, and how do we maximize the angle and the magnitude of that across all parts of a sprint? Starting, accelerating, transitioning, max velocity, and of course, significant and measurable improvements in speed. So everything will come back to this. So first and foremost, this is such a long-term play. The amount of messages I get, hey, do you have any tips, any tricks? Can you give me your best 1, 2, or 3 exercises? It's like, you know, people spend their whole lives doing this, right? People spend hours a day, 5, 6, 7 days a week. It's not gonna happen overnight. And if it was, I'd be making a lot more money. And if I ever figure it out, I'm definitely gonna let you know. And think about how many sprints you've already done with your suboptimal or not as good form, or the form that you wanna change. Not only do we have to accumulate the same amount of reps that are better, but then also way more on top of that to ingrain it and make it natural. So the question really is, how do we consistently move the needle over time on this speed spectrum for improved technique, better force vectors? We improve our start, our acceleration, our transition, our max velocity. And then how do we make that actually reflect on the stopwatch, on the timers, on the field, whatever it may be? So how do we consistently move that needle? So number one is technique / mechanics matter. And this sounds like a no-brainer, but let me explain. So technique is the form. Think if you were to take a picture of someone when you're sprinting, how do they look? And then mechanics is basically form and forces, so including the force vectors. And of course, technique, reduce the risk of injury. Injury happens when forces on the tissue exceed the tissue tolerance, or basically what it can handle. So if our body's in the best position to put the forces in the ground and the best position to handle those forces, well, we reduce the risk of injury and increase performance. And improved mechanics also just increases the stability of the foundation for the skill of sprinting. And the analogy that I have is when you're playing Pokemon, you fire up your Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, Game Boy SP, DS, whatever you played. And if you can't relate to this analogy, I guess you didn't have a childhood, and I really do feel bad for you. So of course, you make your way through Pokemon at the beginning. You're getting impatient and you look up, oh, Brock, gym number 2 in like Lavender Town or whatever it was. And you can look up on the internet specifically what Pokemon he was going to play first, second, third, what level, and also what the weaknesses were of that Pokemon. So with these hacks on the internet, you can just like fly through these gyms, you know what route to go on, and then you get to the Elite Eight. Yes, it's been a little while, but I do miss it. You get to the Elite Eight and you're still looking up the trainers, the Pokemon, what level, what moves they're going to use and stuff like that. But because you cheated all those gyms earlier, you hacked the system. Yes, you know what to play, but your Pokemon simply just aren't strong enough. So you can be doing all of the right things, doing all of the right moves to attack their weaknesses, but because you didn't go through that process of leveling up your Pokemon, there's just such a gap and a discrepancy between your Pokemon and their Pokemon. You just can't make up the difference regardless of if you're doing all of the right technical plays based on the strengths and the weaknesses. So if we bypass improving our technique and our mechanics as that foundation, we're setting us up for a lot of failure later. But I'll humor you, viewer slash listener. Let's say technique doesn't matter. Well, how do we get faster if we don't have to worry about technique? Well, we have to increase our output or the qualities of becoming faster. We have to be bouncier. We have to have better stride frequency, maybe stride length. We have to have more strength. Well, let's say we improve all of those things. We have our 2x body weight squat, even though it's more like 1.7. That's a different rabbit hole. We can jump 30 inches plus. We can do all of those things. Well, then where do you go after that? What happens after you max out those things? Nowhere. That's the hard thing. Because you're adding on all of this ability with such an unstable foundation. So not only do you have no runway to get better later, but also you're just increasing the risk of injury. So with technique mattering, yes, there's even context to this one point that there is no such thing as perfect technique. And of all of the sprinters, all of the types of sprinters you could imagine, there's stride frequency sprinters, there's stride length sprinters, there's sprinters that have relatively small shapes versus what you would call ideal, is sprinters that have really big shapes. There's sprinters like Michael Johnson, if you've ever seen him run. And at the end of the day, that dude was just fast. Now, would you coach athletes to run like him? Obviously not. But to say that he's a bad sprinter because he doesn't fit into some of those molds and boxes of quote-unquote good technique would be completely discrediting that he was just straight up fast. But if you took every sprinter across the Olympic 100-meter finals and you analyzed their flight time to ground contact, their flight time to ground contact time ratios, their shapes in their first step of acceleration, their angle of gradual rise during their transition, I would definitely bet that they are a lot more similar than dissimilar. So just to say that, oh, this one sprinter doesn't do it that way, well, what is the average, what does the most look like? Chances are you're going to have sprinters, athletes that you train, or you yourself are an athlete, that is more similar than dissimilar to everyone else. So if we can move athletes towards these big, consistent rocks, but also play into their strengths and weaknesses as well, well, that's a pretty solid plan, not gonna lie. So if I have an athlete who's a stride frequency athlete, they can just step incredibly fast. Well, I'm gonna do drills that emphasize stride length. Not to make them a stride length dominant sprinter, but to add some stride length to complement their stride frequency. And if we just take a step back and say, what are our processes of becoming faster based on our definition of becoming faster? Well, first it's going to be our postures and shapes, aka technique. Then our rhythms and patterns, so kind of comparing and contrasting the big shapes, the longer ground contacts of acceleration, and then going to the transition, the cycling, the really slow or really fast ground contacts, really long flight times and top speed. And then we have output last. So if we can start with the lowest hanging fruit, and if we can get faster simply just by improving our technique, well, why would we not do that? We're leaving the whole world as our oyster later, and we're just cutting ourselves off for this long-term development. Like I said, there's context. Speed development is a long-term play. If we can get faster just by improving our technique, why would we not? We're leaving everything else for later just to help us continue to get faster and faster and faster. So number two, 95% or better of your best. So Charlie Francis, he created this threshold. A lot of very well-known speed and sprint coaches have adopted it since then. And basically, you have from your fastest time to 5% slower, to be a high intensity, fast training rep. And intensity drives adaptation. People can chase volume. You can chase doing more and more and more. Well, then you're just getting really good at doing a ton of not fast sprints. You have to be close enough to your speed ceiling, close enough to your PR, close enough to your 100% to challenge that to then improve it. So the analogy that I have is, it's just like working on your golf swing, which I'm very good at and I never slice, but only hitting it 80% distance. So let's do some math really quick. I'm really outing myself here. Let's say my drive is 300 yards, obviously, times 0.8 or 80%, 240. So let's say I'm at the range and I only ever hit it, what did I say, 240? 300, oh, this is so bad. 240. Let's say I'm at the range and I only ever hit the ball 240 yards, but my best is 300. But I'm hitting it on an absolute line, no hook, no slice, no fade or draw, just absolutely crushing it, striping it right down the middle of the fairway or the driving range. And someone comes up to me and they say, oh, that's great. You know, like, how's your swing going? Da, da, da. And you're like, oh, it's perfect. I'm hitting straight every time. It's like, oh, well, what's your best? I say 300 yards. So you're only hitting it like 240, 250. I'm like, yeah, I know, but I'm hitting it super straight every time. It's like, well, how is that going to translate over to the course when you actually have to go all out in competition, set yourself up for success? I'm like, I don't know, but I'm hitting it really straight now. You have to be close enough to what you're trying to challenge and improve to actually challenge and improve it. Not that you have to hit it every single time, but if I'm at 280 yards, 290 yards, and I'm hitting it straight, that's going to have a lot more transfer and carryover than if I just sit in that 240, 250 range. And what's nice about the 95% is that it's relative. Every athlete can have their own PR. In the facility that I coach at, I'll go to the next, we have a laminated sheet. And the worst thing my boss ever did was teach me how to use the laminator. So it has a theoretical PR, and it automatically has 95% of that calculated. And every athlete, if they know their PR, they go to the wall and they look and they find what is their 95%. And every sprint we do, we try to be between 95 and 100% of their PR, if not more, and set a new PR. So it's very simple to do. You just take their PR, multiply it times 1.05 or 5% slower, and that's your range to shoot for. And it's also an objective threshold of progress. It's very tough for athletes to wrap their head around this, but you would never max out your bench press and set a new max every single time. But then why do people have this idea in sprinting and speed training that they can and they're disappointed by PRs? It's just super unrealistic to assume that that's going to happen, but 95% is very objective in saying it wasn't our PR, but it was fast enough and that is a high quality training rep. So if you want to get faster, if you want to improve your max speed or your best acceleration, you have to be close enough to it to challenge that. And that's where 95% comes into play. You got to time your sprints. This is almost a non-negotiable. I don't want to speak in absolutes, but this is just like trying to save money on your electricity bill, but you never look at the bill. So you're going out, you're getting dinner with some friends, and you're just comparing and contrasting and adulting and how totally not fun it is because adulting sucks. And you're talking about taxes because those suck too. And you talk about budgeting. And you're talking about how much you make and just like da da da. And just money comes up. And you're like, yeah, you know, like I've really been trying to save money on my electricity. You know, like there was one month that it was just way too high. And I'm just like so over it. It's just such a waste of money. I can definitely be better at saving money on my electricity bill. And, you know, that was 3 months ago. And your friends say, oh, well, how's it going now? How much money have you saved? And you're like, I don't know, but I turn the light off all the time and I don't do laundry twice a week anymore. So I save money on electricity for not using my washer too often. And they're like, I mean, yeah, that makes sense in theory, but like, are you actually saving money though? Like how much money have you saved through all this time and effort that you've put and all this thought and intentionality into using less electricity? I don't know, but I just know that I am. It's a pretty hard argument to sell that you're actually saving money on electricity unless you literally, physically, tangibly can see and know. So if you're not timing your sprints, well, you can say, I feel faster. You can say, my technique is getting better, which is valuable. That was point number one. But at the end of the day, you have to actually know. And timing sprints has so many benefits. It's extremely specific, as I just ranted about. It's very motivating because it's very objective and athletes can wrap their head around, was it within my PR, my 95% PR range or not? And it's just feedback. You know, if you're consistently in that 95 range plus, well, those are good reps. Stay the course. If it's below for a decent amount of time or maybe like even two sessions, I've written an article about this. Well, I'm going to ask more questions. Maybe we should change it up. You know, so it just checks off so many boxes and it'd be hard to justify not timing your sprints if you say you're doing speed training. Number four, you have to bridge the gap. So I'll give some examples first, and then I'll explain kind of the details and nuances. So whenever you're doing speed training, if you're doing top speed focused work and drills, you can do your overspeed, your hurdle slash wicket runs, but you have to bridge the gap by doing actual fly tens after. And if you're doing acceleration, you can do your resistance sprints, your push-up starts, your whatever it may be, but you have to bridge that gap doing short 10, 15 yard races or timed 5:15s, which is our main acceleration test that we do. Or if you're doing agility training, you can work on those change of direction skills, but you have to turn that into agility by doing tag games, by doing reactive tennis ball throws and catches, or by doing partner mirror drills. And the point of this is we can improve the ability of being fast. Does our body have the capacity for fast outputs? But the skill of being fast is doing that very well, basically whenever and wherever. If I had to compare and contrast those definitions, because language matters. And those definitions are definitely a little bit more similar than I planned. But ability is basically the capacity to do it, but the skill is being able to consistently and highly execute it. But when is that skill being required? I was talking through this with an intern the other day, and I said, well, is the point of being faster and coming to TC Boost, where I currently coach, just to be faster in TC Boost? And they said, no, obviously not. I said, well, then why do they come here? I said, to be faster in their sport. Exactly. We don't want to just develop drill warriors. I don't want someone to absolutely crush their dribble series and look picture perfect moving at 5 miles an hour. I want them to crush their top speed when they're chasing down a ball, a through ball on the soccer field, because I totally know soccer lingo. And although we pick these drills and interventions in speed training to slow stuff down, to develop a certain shape, pattern, rhythm, a technique, to develop something, to exaggerate or emphasize something that they lack or their weakness to then complement their strength, well, you have to put it all together for them. You have to do things that truly help it transfer or bridge the gap. So it's like doing all of the jerk accessory drills, but then never actually jerking. So Olympic lifting, you have your snatch and your clean and jerk. So if you want to get better at jerking, well, if you only do behind the neck jerk and you only do squat jerks and you only do those heavy jerk stand-up things where you have the pins really high and you stand it up and you've had a training partner for, you know, a few months and they're like, oh, you know, I can see you've really been putting in the time and effort to get better at improving your jerk for your clean and jerk, you know, like, how is your max improved? And you just stand there and you're like, well, it hasn't. But I mean, I look really good. I feel really good. Like, these drills are going super, super well. And they're just like, well, you're like trying to improve your jerk, though. So you have to actually do the jerk. Like, have those drills helped? Like, yes, I would admit you definitely look way better. Be like, I don't know. So you're not trying to become a behind the neck jerk warrior or a squat jerk warrior when you're going to split jerk in a competition. Now, those accessories are extremely valuable. And you would assume they transfer, but you have to make them transfer by actually doing the jerk, right? You have to be very good at the dribble series, for example, to work on the cycling of top speed, but you have to then actually do top speed sprints and running to help bridge that gap and actually make you have to make it transfer. Although it does, you have to make it. I feel like that's a more succinct way to put it. And basically, you have to make training game-like at the end of a session, at the end of a drill series, because that's what we're training for. We work on the ability or the capacity to be fast in all of these facets of maximizing force vectors, starting positions, acceleration, transition, and top speed. But the point of that is that it's all better during games. So how do we not create soccer practice in the facility, but how do we make drills that are game-like, where the brain is off, where they're reacting off of someone else, where they're sprinting all out and their only thought is not lose when they're racing, for example. So you definitely have to bridge the gap in speed training. And last, I have to give you some concrete, actual speed training things that you can do starting tomorrow, because at the end of the day, you actually have to do this stuff. So if I had to give two things that I 100% believe in and advocate for in speed training when it comes to drills is flying sprints. I've made content about this before, about how I believe every athlete should do flying sprints regardless of their sport. I think that there's too many benefits to ignore it. And for example, let's say like a tennis player or like a basketball player, someone who sprints never really gets up to top speed. For example, a basketball court is 92, 94 feet, something like that. And even if they do a full sprint, the entire 90 whatever feet, which they never actually do the full court, well, they're going to be near their top speed, but not actually in their top speed and within, 30 yards or 90 feet. So why is it valuable to them? Or a tennis player, for example, where they only ever sprint maybe a few steps at a time, it's a lot more lateral. Well, if we increase our absolute speed, so if we raise our speed ceiling from 20 miles an hour to 22, well, everything else raises up as well. So our 50% goes from 10 miles an hour then up to 11 miles an hour. So for example, if that tennis player is taking three steps and they get up to, let's say 50% of their speed in those three steps, well, they just got up to 11 miles an hour instead of 10. Or for example, if getting to that one ball only requires them to get up to 10 miles an hour, well, 10 miles an hour divided by 22 is less of a percent. So to reach the same speed, it's consequently easier, more economical, and they won't use as much energy. And that's where the speed reserve comes in. If you have more of a gap between what's required of you and your speed ceiling, the reserve, well, you can do the same things as before. It's just going to be easier. And the benefits of ankle stiffness, hamstring strength, and health is just too much to ignore. And it's the fastest thing that the human body can do. So there's nervous system benefits to challenging the body's nervous system. Going back to the 95% plus point number two. And the nervous system is used in every part of sport. So why would you not want to challenge the nervous system? It's just a different new stimulus. And so that would be for top speed running. And for resisted sprints, I think getting up to a 50% VDEC, a 25% VDEC, even a 10% VDEC for your contrast work, I think that there's just too many benefits to resisting a sprint for the sprint specific strength for the ankles, the hamstrings. And it just teaches too many big rocks of acceleration that are hard to replicate or get a lot of volume in otherwise. So I always say that the heavier you resist a sprint, the closer to the beginning of the sprint you are replicating. So if I'm doing a 50% VDEC, velocity decrement, or where the load is making the athlete run at half their speed, even with all out effort, well, then I can get 10 yards working on those first few steps as opposed to just a few steps of working on those few steps, if you're following me. So to teach that aggressive body angle, the just aggressive nature of acceleration and the big shapes, the big aggressive arms and elbows and knees, I just think there's too much benefit to ignore and not do resisted sprints. So here's what didn't make the cut. lifting, Big Sad, not Big Sad, that's later. Rightfully so, lifting did not make the cut. Now, it's not to say that it's not valuable, but it didn't crack the top five. And here's an example. So I was doing a workout in TC Boost, and an intern was watching me, and I was just doing like hang snatches. And they said, whoa, that's what a snatch is supposed to look like. I see all of our high schoolers do it, and they listed a few, and they said, it just doesn't look snappy. It doesn't look athletic and coordinated, and it's just very awkward. But like, that's how it's supposed to look. Now, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I've been doing it for longer. But the same kids he was referencing are faster than me. So am I trying to get better at the snatch for the snatch, or am I trying to get better at the snatch to make me faster? And I think it's very important to keep that thought and question in the back of your mind when you're doing things like lifting. Now, there is value, right? Increase output, because strength is a foundation of power and speed, to reduce the risk of injury by increasing the robustness and just what the body can handle. But does it transfer? What's the end goal? So yes, it's valuable, but you have to take a step back and say, what is the context of me lifting? Now, the context of a powerlifter lifting is way different than the power of a team sport or a sprinter lifting. Jumping did not make the cut, rightfully so. And this is an example I gave on another podcast I was on not too long ago. So if I have an athlete and their vertical increases 1 inch, but I drop their fly 10 time down by a tenth of a second, is that more or less valuable than if I have an athlete, their vertical goes up 5 inches, but their fly 10 time only drops a hundredth of a second? Well, I'll take the drop tenth any day. I don't care about the vertical. Like, do you know Usain Bolt's vertical? I don't. I've never seen a video of him jump. Now, I'm sure it would be impressive because they're connected, but like, correlation is not causation. So the example I also gave was, we jump every day and we measure it, but we do it to prime our speed work later, to finish our warm-up and get the body really fast and bouncy and explosive, not necessarily to directly get better at jumping. So there's always context. And last, rest periods did not make the cut. Big sad. This is an actual big sad because it is important. And this ties into the 95% principle. You have to be intentional about your rest periods to be recovered enough to run fast enough, 95% plus, to actually get that stimulus. So when athletes are jogging back, when it's a one-to-one work to rest ratio, you're just not setting yourself up for success to get high quality speed training. So the general rule of thumb is 1 minute rest for every 10 yards sprinted. So if we're doing a 5:15, where the athlete starts on the zero, the first laser is 5 yards away and the second laser is 15 yards away, well, this is in general a minute and a half rest. So if my athlete is going, they do their sprint, they kind of slow down. When they turn around and start walking back, I'll start my watch. Or if we're doing a fly 10, although it's 10 yards, it's not actually 10 yards. You know, you build up and you sprint maybe 15, 20 yards. So that's about 2 minutes plus rest. So being intentional about those things takes a lot of guessing out of the equation in, is my athlete actually below 95% or are they just not recovered enough? So I think rest periods are definitely valuable and don't get as much credit as they probably deserve. So thank you, good luck, run fast, and I will see you next time.